Good afternoon. Welcome, everyone, to House State Affairs Committee, Thursday, February 23rd, coming to order at 3:06 p.m. in the Max Gruenberg Room in the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Josephson? Representative Knopf?
Here.
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Kopp? Representative Ledoux? Chair Christ Tompkins?
Here. And with six members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Representative Ledoux has advised us earlier she will be in and out today. And thank you, Martha and Kyle, for keeping things running, as well as Stephanie for ably facilitating the committee. Reminder to silence all cell phones per usual. We have two items on today's agenda. First up, House Bill 91 relating to APOC registration fees. This is the fourth hearing, I believe. Potentially the last hearing. We'll see as the committee hearing goes. And second item on today's agenda is House Bill 1, top billed legislation this legislative session in the House, election registration and voting legislation from Representative Tuck. That'll be the first hearing. And with House Bill 91 as previously advertised in the last hearing, there is a committee substitute forthcoming that the sponsor has been working on. We also have a couple of amendments on the table to work through, and we'll just sort of see as things go whether we sort of feel it's mature for committee action as the hearing unfolds. But to get things kicked off, especially with the sneak preview we had last hearing, there's a proposed committee substitute, and can I entertain a motion to adopt CS30-LS00667-D is the working document for the committee.
I would so move for adoption.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. And if the sponsor and staff would be available to speak to the committee substitute and what is contained therein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Keto from District 33, Northern Southeast Alaska, including downtown Juneau and the Capitol building in which we sit. I will let my staff, Crystal Kieneman, provide an update on what the committee substitute includes, and then we will both be available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Crystal Kieneman, staff to Representative Keto. The work draft that we have before us, version D, in section 1, you'll notice some revisions in the language. This language has been modified to tie the candidate filing fee to the election cycle. And so there is some language that's in there, Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned, that there is there are a couple of amendments. One of the amendments does deal with that section, and we can go into more detail when with the discussion of that. There was some question in Section 2 with the civil penalty fees that the language in discussing with APOC that wasn't clear enough. In discussions with our legal team, it was determined that the language, the civil penalty language, was sufficient in Section 2, so there have been no changes to that. In Section 3 of the bill, you will notice that this is where the most substantial change is. This is where the stair step for the lobbyist fees is in place. So you will notice still the removal of the $250, which is the current lobbying fee in statute. And on page 2, line 31, is where the new language starts, stating for each lobbying contract, a lobbyist shall pay a fee of, and we're on the top of page 3, lines 1 through 5, a fee of sub 1, $350 for a contract with a value of less than $30,000. Sub 2 is $650 for a contract with a value of between $30,000 and $60,000. And sub 3 states $850 for a contract with a value of more than $60,000. Additionally, you will see the removal of the tax language that was put in. So that is no longer contained in this piece of legislation. And with that, Mr. Chairman, those are the changes contained in the bill, and we're available for questions.
Are there questions from the committee on the CS as introduced? And hearing none, and also noting that we'll have the opportunity to continue to discuss the piece of legislation as a whole, I'm going to remove my objection to adopting this as the committee, the CS rather. Is there any further objection? And hearing none, CS30/LS0067/D is adopted as the committee substitute, which brings us with that as the new iteration of the piece of legislation before us. Are there questions for the sponsor or staff? I guess on the same document, the CS, as introduced. Seeing none, I do know we have some amendments on the table, and we have one conceptual amendment, I believe, originating from the sponsor that Representative Tuck may be offering on the sponsor's behalf, and we also have an amendment by Representative Knopp. Perhaps we could start with a conceptual amendment if that suits Representative Tuck, and move to your amendment after that, Representative Knopp. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move conceptual amendment number one.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically what this does is it corrects a slight drafting error. Underneath the committee substitute, we have on page 1, line 11, it shows that we have a declaration of candidacy under AS 1525030. Declarations of candidacies are a function of the Division of Elections and not the function of Alaska Public Offices Commission. So actually trying to make that correction and deleting that material and inserting 1513060C, which is the requirement that people file a file with the APOC commission, their treasurer, their deputy treasurers within 15 days of the filing. That's the actual requirement. Once someone does declare, that's the required filing to deal with APOC and their candidacy. So it puts it back underneath the Alaska Public Offices Commission.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Any questions from members of the committee on conceptual amendment number one? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adoption of conceptual amendment number one? And seeing no further objection, amendment number one, or conceptual amendment number one, is adopted. Moving to the next amendment on the table, I guess this would be amendment number two from Representative Knopp, and for clarity purposes, this is LS00667/D.1. Representative Knopp, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move amendment as you just read.
Moving amendment number one, number two. I will object for purposes of discussion. Representative Knopp, would you be able to speak?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can walk everybody through the amendment if you so desire. Just let me know. If not, I'll just touch on my talking points, and I'm sure there'll be some questions. But so I'll just read a brief statement I prepared, and then I'll just ad lib a little bit after that. So. In a nutshell, this amendment as proposed would eliminate the requirement that individuals appointed to boards and commissions must file a public official financial disclosure, therefore eliminating them from the proposed annual registration fee of $50 in Section 7 of this bill. At this point, I could walk through the amendment, but where I want to ad lib on this, and this is in this whole budget cycle, I started on this particular budget document because I was a little uncomfortable that we didn't look at the way agencies do their business. But this is one that I've paid attention to for probably 15 years and wondered why we did what we did, because serving in local government, we struggle all the time to find candidates to run for the local boards and commissions, school boards, and even the appointed boards. It's tough. And when they get to the APOC filing, this discourages them even more so than by adding a fee to that, again, even more so. So my hope is by eliminating the reporting requirements for them boards and commissions appointed ones, that we will have more participation and encourage more people to apply for them. So that is really the purpose of proposing this. It's kind of streamlined. But the second, what I think is really a beneficial component, and I thank the sponsor for the bill and bringing that to light, is that the workload on the organization is so immense right now that with the staffing and the budget situation the way it is, they almost can't comply. I mean, it's almost impossible with the staffing levels that they have. So if this thing passes, you're going to give them some funding to help support their mission, alleviate some of the workload, and hopefully at the end of the day we get more public participation in their local boards and commissions. And so I'll leave it at that, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman, and if anybody would like me to touch on the proposed amendments, just let me know. I'd be glad to. But you all have copies of it. So,
are there any questions for the amendment sponsor? Representative Wohl.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure I even do. I just, the amendment is to remove the requirement for filing. It's nothing to do with the fee, although you did mention the fee. But this basically says anyone, if you're running for city council or borough assembly, you're no longer required to fill out the APOC financial statement forms, I'm guessing. That's where this is going?
No, sir. No.
Okay.
Boards and appointments, not public officials.
Okay, not public officials.
Not assemblies, not councils. No, you're still under the requirements there. I'm talking school boards, co-op boards, electric.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah.
And maybe at this time, does the sponsor or staff have thoughts or comments on amendment number two?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. So one of the things that was a bit concerning with me on the bill as far as instituting the $50 fee for the financial disclosure is a recognition that the work has to be done by the Alaska Public Offices Commission, but I also understand that those positions are volunteer positions and those individuals aren't compensated, so it would be an extra out-of-pocket fee for those individuals that are volunteering for boards, commissions, school boards, and things like that. So this would actually lighten up the load on the Alaska Public Offices Commission as far as having to try and audit, because they are required by statute to audit 100% of their filings. And what they have told us is they have not been able to audit 100% of the filings every year just because of the volume of the workload.
And I think maybe at this time, just to get one more perspective, because we have Heather Hebden, Executive Director of APOC, online, ask you, Ms. Hebden, if you might have any comment on the proposed amendment number two, at this time.
Through the chair, thank you. I don't have the CS in front of me, so I cannot see the specific language or the specific statute that it cites to. But if it's my understanding that what we are talking about is exempting volunteer appointed municipal board and commission members, then yes, that would relieve quite a bit of work on behalf of the agency. I'm curious, though, to see the statutes, and I want to clarify that we're talking on the municipal level and not on the state board and commission level.
And Ms. Hebden, I believe that's accurate, but I'll ask Representative Knopp to speak to clarify on that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Heather, in the normal course of business, I would have gotten you a copy of this proposed amendment. It got to all of us late, so my apologies for that. And no, ma'am, my intent is not just the local boards and commission, but the state boards and commissions as well. Some of them are compensated, some are not compensated. As you know, not all boards and commissions at this point in time are required to for APOC filing or even confirmation for that matter. So, you know, nothing is absolutely perfect, but we think this is a great start. And then, and we're more than willing in the future, if we anticipate problems or issues, to look at this thing again. But because we have it in front of us now, the intent was to include the state-appointed boards and commissions.
And Ms. Hebden, do you have further comment given that clarification?
The Chair, Representative Knopp, thank you for that, and I did receive word from your office regarding this, so I understand that there was some time constraints involved. And as far as the state-level board and commission members, again, that would help immensely as far as decreasing the workload. It's always been an issue because we do rely heavily on third-party sources for this type of information regarding appointments and terminations of terms. So it is a difficult tracking procedure as well. So, yes, I would definitely agree that this could potentially help our workload quite a bit.
Representative Ledoux.
So I'd like an example. I mean, I'd like to know, and this question actually is directed to Representative Knopp, because he said, as you know, there are various boards and commissions that people are not required to file for. What aren't people required to file for now? What's exempted now?
And Representative Knopp, just before you answer, note that if it would also be helpful, your staff, Ms. Bloomer, would be welcome to testify as well, just to note on process.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and replying to Representative Ledoux. I believe the one that comes to mind right now is I think the AGDC board is exempt from filing, and I'd actually like to defer to Heather. She probably knows more about that than I do. Maybe we could ask her the question.
Ms. Hebden, did you hear Representative Ledoux's question? If so, can you respond?
For the Chair, yes, Representative Ledoux. Unfortunately, I have in front of me a list of everyone required to file, but I do not have the contrasting list. I could easily go to the governor's site and pull up the boards and commissions, but of the existing ones, there's only 40 that are specifically required under our statutes that report.
And Ms. Hebden, I have a follow-up question. Could you maybe to give us a sense of some of those 40 boards and commissions that are on the list and are currently required to file POFDs, could you give us sort of a smattering of what some of those boards and commissions are?
Sure. The Alaska State Council on the Arts, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, State Assessment Review Board, Board of Education and Early Development, the Alaska Public Broadcasting Commission, the Alaska Public Offices Commission, Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Fishermen's Fund Advisory and Appeals Council. Moving on out of the A's, Big Game Commercial Services Board, Board of Agriculture and Conservation, the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. So I would agree with an exemption. However, I think that there should be a little bit more scrutiny, probably in the sense of applying a blanket exemption. Some of these boards and commissions do oversee significant policy decision-making, and it may still be a good idea to have them report.
Thank you, Ms. Hebden. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question as it relates, since we're kind of in the amendments, kind of talking about who's in and who's out and who's going to be kind of participating in this exercise. One of the things that the provisions of this not necessarily this amendment, but just in total, is the subsection does not apply to volunteer lobbyists or representational lobbyists. Could you give me, Ms. Hebden, an indication as to do volunteer lobbyists or representational lobbyists, do they register in any way now, and how does that manage? As long are they exempt, or how does that work?
Through the Chair, Representative Birch, I do not believe that a volunteer lobbyist is required to file the registration with our office.
Follow up?
So they might hit the prescribed number of hours per year to be identified as a lobbyist. I can't remember what it is. It's a certain number of hours a week or a month or a year, and then you cross over that threshold, then you are a lobbyist. So I understand on the volunteer, so that there's no threshold there since they're not getting paid. Is that my understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I believe that you're referring to the 10-hour rule?
Yes.
Yes.
So if I volunteer, which implies as a volunteer you don't get paid, if you volunteer as a lobbyist, do you have to meet the 10-hour rule, or can you just basically lobby all year long for free without being registered?
To the chair, Representative Birch, I don't have a direct answer to that question.
Really? Okay. How about a representational lobbyist? Could you characterize or describe what a representational lobbyist is, since they're, and again, as it relates to this, we're not including that in this, but can, is that, could you describe that for me?
Again, through the chair, Representative Birch, I don't have a direct answer to that. I'm happy to follow up with more information. My focus has never been on the lobbying side of our particular laws. However, it is my understanding that the volunteer and representational lobbyists, their focus is other than lobbying.
And Representative Birch, for Cody, are you referring to language in the amendment, Amendment Number 2?
Well, since we're
in the CS,
we're talking about what's included, which boards are included and which are not included. I'm trying to get kind of an overall understanding of, you know, how many people. I think at one time we had a reference that there's 1,200 annual reports on the POFDs, and we, you know, and so I'm just trying to figure out if we're including everybody in this, you know, in the boards and commissions, and to the representative from the Kenai, I kind of agree with the effort of trying to, you know, get people out of out of this process, and just trying to figure out how best to do it and who it includes. Thank you.
Sure, and I guess to the point you just raised, Representative Birch, Ms. Hebden, do you have a sense of the 1,200 or however many POFDs are filed annually? How many of those POFDs come from public officials who would be exempted from that POFD requirement by Representative Knopf's amendment? In maybe ballpark terms?
In ballpark terms, how many would be exempted under the boards and commissions if we were talking about both state and municipal level? I would say maybe 600. But also, I would like to note that when we're talking the 1,200 annual filers, I'm not sure where that number comes from, but it's important to note that in communities of less than 15,000, their municipal filers do not file with our office, and they are not required to file electronically. So many of these forms are filed with their clerks via paper. So it would be helpful for me to know where your numbers are coming from, but I could certainly break out a list of filers by their requirement to file, as far as breaking it down to your boards and commissions or even municipal filers. I don't have that number in front of me right now.
And I think Representative Birch might have been working from memory, but do you know how many POFDs are filed with you at APOC annually?
If you mean electronically, I would ballpark it at 1,300, maybe 1,350. But that does include across the spectrum, and there are municipal filers in there as well.
Thank you, Ms. Hebden. Representative Knopf, did you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heather, so the other day my staff contacted you, I believe, and the numbers you give me then, I think we took them off your website, and I think we also took some off the website, but you had 1,268 listed on the website for a POFD, and my staff talk to you specifically about the boards and commissions, and the number you give us at that time was 360. And so there was a few other numbers, and I apologize. I don't have that information with me today. I didn't realize there was going to be a need for it. I didn't bring it, so I apologize for that. But if I don't know if that triggers anything, but the boards and commission one, you quoted me 360, I believe.
For the chair, Representative Knopf, that would have been state boards and commissions.
Okay, thank you for that.
That would not include any of the municipal board and commission members that we're talking about.
Representative Ledoux.
All right, I've got a couple of questions, and the first one is this language about excluding representational lobbyists and volunteer lobbyists. Where is this language? I'm not seeing the language.
Permission to dialogue.
Please, Representative Bruce, Representative Ledoux.
I kind of like that dialogue business. If you go to page 2, line 29.
Of the work draft?
I'm sorry, this is off the committee substitute. You go to page 2, line 29, it says that the
commission may not accept an application for registration or renew a registration until the fee is paid. And then it goes on to say, this subsection does not apply to a volunteer lobbyist under AS 244516 or a representational lobbyist under regulations of the commission. So it brings the brings up the question of if we're talking about lobbyists and having lobbyists register, why are we exempting a whole, you know, and I mean, who's keeping track of volunteer lobbyists and representational lobbyists? And that was the question.
My confusion was, I thought we were actually on this amendment right now.
I think the amendment is speaking to exempting other boards and commissions and the myriad of other organizations that are asked to provide part of the 1,200 or 1,300 POFD forms on an annual basis.
Thank you. Might respond for through
Representative
the chair,
Kito.
Representative Burt. So I think what is happening is there's a little bit of a conflation of two different things going on. The amendment actually addresses the filers for the public official financial disclosure, and the bill language you're talking about regarding volunteer and representational lobbyists is just talking about who has to register as a lobbyist. That's a completely different situation. The representational and volunteer lobbyists have to follow certain rules before they're considered lobbyists. And one of the reasons for this bill actually would be to help support Ms. Hebden, because there is limited resource availability from the lobbying side of the Alaska Public Offices Commission to provide that direct testimony on what's happening on the lobbying side. There's resources available on the campaign side. So I think that discussion might be able to be postponed until we get past the amendment and into the discussion of the overall bill.
Perfect. Thank you.
Then I will reserve my second question until we get back to the bill.
Representative Ledoux's question is reserved. Any questions on the amendment, Representative Wolf?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I need some clarification, and pardon me for that. But so the amendment is to exempt certain members of state boards or commissions, the municipal school utility boards, city, borough, unified municipal planning and zoning commissions. Now, I believe, so is that not all state boards, just certain state boards? And Ms. Hebden, I believe, said that some should be kept in place simply because the scope of their policy decisions may necessitate that they do file, but others, it sounded like, would be welcome to be omitted from the requirement because it's a large workload and maybe discourages people from taking these positions. So if someone could clarify it, that would be great.
Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wool, Representative Wool, thank you for that, because I thought I was the only one who was reading that particular line like that. exempting certain members, and of course legal drafts this, not I, but the only reason I can figure that's in there is, as Mr. Hebden mentioned, because not all members are required to file. She mentioned only 40 boards and commissions, so I would expect that is the certain members that is referencing, because the other ones are not required. That's the only way I could read that. I could not figure that out either. Didn't have time before committing to follow up with legal on that particular phrase. And so that is how I understood that, sir.
Okay. And
follow up, Representative Wolf.
I guess this is for Ms. Hebden. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, Heather. And she previously said that some, in her opinion, should be maintained, while others could be afforded not be maintained. And I just want to verify that that's what she said.
Ms. Hebden, could you speak to Representative Wool's question?
The Chair, yes, Representative Wool, that is what I meant.
And Ms. Hebden, could you perhaps speak to a few boards and commissions that strike you as having significant policymaking powers that strike you as perhaps meriting inclusion for POFD requirements?
Certainly, I'm looking right now, and I would say the University of Alaska Board of Regents, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. I would really need to take a closer look at all of them, but, I mean, just looking at the page right now, those two stand out.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Heather, I won't disagree with you that maybe some should. I don't know that I would agree with you on them particular too, but so the one board that I mentioned that is not required is one probably of all of them I think should. And so do you know why that in them cases we have not? How did that structure come around that they were exempted? And I'm kind of curious of a few other ones. I wish you had that list in front of you, and I don't have it either, of those that are not.
Through the Chair, Representative Wool, if you took a look at our definitions and how the chapter has progressed as far as the state boards and commissions that are required to file, you'll see that they cite to various, probably 40 different statutes that require the public official financial disclosure. So to tell you how this has come about would be quite a long tail, I believe.
And at this time, I'm going to take a brief at ease to maybe see if we can connect a few dots. We'll go off the record for a few minutes.
Wow, that was loud.
Yeah. I need a bigger hammer for you.
Going back on the record. All right, well, Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, at this time, I would like to make a conceptual friendly amendment to my own amendment, and so I would ask that on page 1, line 2, delete the word certain members of state boards, and so it would just read exempting, delete certain members of state boards, and then it would just read exempting boards, and then exempting boards or commissions, or exempting municipal school and utility boards. So you would delete the state board component of that.
And
ask Mr. Keto's staff if I got that correctly.
And I'm going to object for discussion and perhaps suggest we rephrase the motion for clarity in that perhaps we're removing state boards and commissions, also making a conforming change or amendment to the amendment throughout the entirety of the amendment. Although, maybe before making another motion, Ms. Kenneman, would you like to speak to what we're talking about?
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Crystal Kenneman, staff to Representative Keto. Representative Knopp, you are on the right trail by amending the title. There will be conforming amendments if you go to page 2 of the amendment, lines 3, after of. Strike state board or commission, so that language in the amendment would read, starting on line 2, a public official who is a chair or member of municipal, school, or utility boards or city, borough, or municipal planning and zoning commissions is not required to file a statement. So that was what the new, from my understanding, Representative Knopp, what the new language would state.
And Representative Knopp, would you be willing to restate your motion?
Yes, through the chair. So the motion. Do I, Mr. Chair, can you brief at ease here? Let me get this cleared
sure.
up, please.
Back on, going back on record, I think what we're going to do, considering expediency, and that even though this is the fourth hearing for this bill, because this amendment is relatively substantial in scope, and there are a lot of questions, including the scope of the amendment, is hold the bill, and it's already passed the hearing and noticing requirement for next week in finance, which is the next committee referral. I'm going to take this up as the first item of business on Tuesday, which in terms of progress for this bill, and I know the sponsor is keenly aware of this, given this is the fourth hearing for this particular piece of legislation, should not have a substantial impact on its pace. Representative Tucker and Representative Birch on this point.
Just point of order, we got two motions. We got the motion right now to adopt amendment to the amendment. So are we going to withdraw those motions and then hold the bill, or do we want to go ahead and follow through with the motions?
Great point, Representative Tuck, and I think we can get back to the maker of those motions shortly. I think one of the motions was withdrawn, and we went at ease before I think the second motion was completed. So if that's unless the maker of those motions feels otherwise, Representative Birch, did you have a comment you'd like to make?
Just in general, on the thank you, Mr. Chair. On volunteer lobbyists and representational lobbyists, we had a little bit of a sidebar on that earlier. But I would be interested in knowing, since we are looking at who's identified as a lobbyist. I don't have a sense for if there's any registration involved or if we have a number involved. I mean, if there's 10 or 50 or 500. And I just would, maybe between now and next time we get together, we can gather up that information.
Noted, Representative Burson. I think we can work with a sponsor in Ms. Hepton to track down that information. And Representative Ledoux, hold on one second. We'll just sort of clear up any ambiguity about motions on the table. Representative Knopp, I believe you were perhaps in the process of making an amendment to your amendment. Would you like to speak to your intents?
Mr. Chair, thank you. So since we have some questions that need to be answered, and it appears that the chair is willing to hold this while we work through them, so at this time, Mr. Chairman, I would like to withdraw my conceptual amendment, and I would like to withdraw my amendment number one, the committee amendment 30-LS0067-D.1. And we'll work on that and reintroduce it at the next meeting.
Thank you, Representative Knopp. And just to note for clarity, that amendment that was just withdrawn, amendment number 2, I believe, but same work number, LS0067-D.1. Representative Ledoux, do you still have a comment?
I was wondering if Ms. Hebden is on the phone and I could ask her a question, not about the amendment, but about the bill in general before we leave this bill.
Sure. A closing question, Representative Ledoux.
Yeah. Heather, could you explain the difference between a volunteer and a representational lobbyist?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, a representational lobbyist is someone that engages in lobbying for an entity. They receive no compensation, though, or fees other than reimbursement of their travel and personal living expenses. Representational lobbyists are required to register, but they do not file reports.
And a volunteer lobbyist, the difference is then that the volunteer lobbyist is flying on their own dime?
The chair, Representative Ledoux, that is correct. They receive no compensation and no reimbursement for personal expenses. They are not also required to register, nor are they required to report.
All right. Thank you very much.
And this time, I think we're going to shelve House Bill 91, alas, after its fourth hearing, but it'll be back and move on to the next item of today's agenda, House Bill 1, relating to election registration and voting. Thank you, Division of Elections team, for patiently waiting in the audience. And Representative Tuck, would you be willing to present the bill with staff?
Yes.
Good afternoon. I'm Representative Chris Tuck, representing District 22, South Central, 23, the old 22, the new 23, South Central Anchorage, here to present House Bill 1. Along with me is Kendra Klosser, staff to my office. I want to thank the committee for allowing us to present House Bill 1. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Vice Chairman. Thank you, committee chairs. Basically, what House Bill 1 does is it includes a series of changes designed to increase voter participation and access to voting across the state by improving and clarifying the voter process. The right to vote embodies the spirit of American democracy. Casting a vote is one of the most discreetly effective ways to have one's voice heard in the political process. And when we exercise our right to vote, we impact our community far beyond an election. We are able to elect individuals who will make decisions on our behalf and how our government will be run, set up the policies that will guide our state, and how resources, both national and local, are distributed. But unfortunately, we have a lot of Americans that don't exercise their right to vote. On average, only about half of eligible U.S. voters cast ballots. Although Alaska is one of the handful of states which exceed 50% voter turnout in 2014, almost half of Alaskan voters are effectively not being heard. So what this bill does is provide same-day voter registration to allow all eligible Alaskans the opportunity to vote. It enhances online voter registration with electronic signatures to make the registration process quicker and easier and hopefully more efficient and cost-effective for the department division, ensuring the same-day voting locations are available during every election, and then creating an option for permanent absentee voting for individuals that plan to vote by mail year after year, and then clarifying and unifying terminology for early voting to remove confusion between early voting and absentee in-person voting. And so hopefully by adopting House Bill 1, we can take a step forward to increase the voter turnout here in Alaska.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. A note on process. This has been noticed also for next Tuesday, so I figure we can get into a few questions and overview the bill and take more decisive action next week. Are there any questions for Representative Tuck? Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tuck, I need a little help with permanent absentee. What is a permanent absentee?
Okay, through the chair, Representative Knopp. Currently, we have, if someone were to walk in to a voting location to early vote, it's an in-person absentee voting. Well, that's kind of an oxymoron. Which is it? Are you in-person or are you absentee? And so there has been cases in the past where people have actually been turned away from voting because even poll watchers there was confusion there, and they said, well, you have to be absentee to vote absentee. That's not necessarily true. It's just the term that the Division of Elections uses to how they process that ballot. So, for example, I don't have to be absent to vote in my district. I can vote from the convenience of my home by voting absentee. And so voting absentee is a form of early voting. Voting absentee is a form of voting by mail. And so when you walk into an election polling location and you are there prior to the day of election, it's in-person absentee voting.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Ledoux.
I don't have a question for Representative Tuck or Kendra, but I have a kind of a general voting question for someone from the Division of Elections. Would that be appropriate here?
Yeah, I think so. Ms. Banky, are you free, or Ms. Backler from the Department of Law? Please, Representative Lee, proceed with your question.
So, one of the things that I've noticed as I've gone around to my district and door-to-door for people on numerous occasions, I will be at a household, and the person who is registered to vote there is no longer living there. And the person who answers the door will say, oh, yeah, I bought this house, 10 years ago. Mr. Smith lives over on the south side. But I'll look at my walk list file, and it will show that Mr. Smith keeps voting in my district. And so in the past, I've asked the Division of Elections, is there any way that a candidate or a poll watcher or anybody else can challenge Mr. Smith's vote? Because just like you're not allowed to, you know, if you don't live in Alaska, you're not, unless an exception applies, like you're in the military or something, you can't simply, you know, come back here on election day or vote in Alaska if you're no longer a resident of Alaska. So I've asked previous directors, is there any way to challenge that person's vote? And I've been told no, presumptively, that if they're registered to vote there, that there's no way to do it. And I want to know whether or not what I've been told is correct, and if it is correct, what we can do about that.
Okay. All right. Well, good afternoon to the committee. Chairman Christ-Hopkins, for the record, my name is Josie Banky. I'm the Division Director at Elections. Just want to thank you for having the opportunity to address the committee today with those questions. And through the chair, Representative Ledoux, you had asked about the ability for, is there any way that a voter could challenge the validity of somebody who is a permanent absentee voter? Is that what
No, you're not a permanent absentee voter. Somebody who comes and they're living on the south side of Anchorage and they keep coming back to Midtown, for example, because maybe Midtown is closer to where they work. And so they've never changed their registration, but they no longer have any property there. They're no longer, for all practical purposes, a resident of Midtown. And, you know, elections are won and lost in this state by, you know, sometimes a coin toss, sometimes less than 10 votes. So it seems like if somebody is voting in a district that they no longer live in, that's inappropriate. And if somebody knows that that's the case, why isn't there any mechanism, if there's not, to challenge a person who is voting out of their district?
Through the chair. Representative Ledoux, I'm not sure. I mean, is this a part of House Bill 1, or you're just asking this question?
This is a general question.
Okay. Do you want to take a step?
Through the chair. I'm sorry. I'm new at doing this. So to the chair and members of the committee, my name is Lori Wilson. I'm a regional election supervisor here in Juneau. To answer your question through the chair, Representative Ledoux, a voter... There are times when a voter will move and they don't update their residence address with the Division of Elections. And it's up to the voter to notify the division of an address change. There are times, for example, if you were in your polling place in your precinct and that voter was in your precinct at the same time voting, a member of that precinct while in the polling place voting could challenge a voter's eligibility at that precinct at the time of voting, and then that voter would vote a question ballot, and then that ballot would be subject to review by the question by the review board and by the staff there. And during the review process, the absentee review process and the question review process, we have observers that are there during that process, and if they wanted to challenge the eligibility while we're under the review process, those challenges can be brought forth to the director and can be looked at that way. But it is up to the voter to let us know when they change their residence. And the law allows, you know, a person to have one place of residence, but there are exceptions when they can be away from that residence and still continue to vote.
No, I
Representative Ledoux and Ms. Wilson, I mean, I appreciate where the questions are going, and I, too, am interested in the answer. I suspect there'll be hearings. In fact, we've been in conversations about hearings at elections at large, and I wonder if we might be able to focus today's presentation specifically on the contents of House Bill 1. At the same time, I don't want to rein in your agency to ask questions.
Well, the reason that I'm asking the questions is because I want to see whether or not perhaps this bill should get amended to state something about that. So is there, so if, with your indulgence?
Please, follow up, Representative Ledoux.
So is there any specific format? I mean, I know at one point I actually wanted to object to some folks voting in an election. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem like there was any mechanism for me to do so.
Currently, if you had, if you went down the voter registration list and said, this person doesn't live here, this person doesn't live here, this person doesn't live here, we can't just simply remove voters from the voter rolls or inactivate them because you say that they don't live at that address. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Well, I realize that. Mm-hmm. So is there some mechanism in which if you have knowledge that somebody is not living there, that you could sign an affidavit saying what reasons you know that somebody is not living there, and then you would contact that voter to see actually where they're living? How do you show it? What's the mechanism?
We can, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, if we have something that's in question, sometimes we have individuals that contact us and say somebody's still using our residence address as their voting residence, but they no longer live here. The law is pretty broad in the intent of a voter, even if they moved for temporary reasons or whatever, and the law says as long as they have the intent to return, they can continue voting in Alaska and don't register and vote somewhere else, they can continue to use that residence address for voting purposes.
Follow up?
Okay, that's the law with respect to people who move out of state and maybe thinking about returning in state. I'm thinking about somebody who has a home in Southside and sells that home in Southside and has no intention of returning to that home in Southside because they've now got a home in Midtown.
Mm-hmm. Okay, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it is up to the individual to notify the division to let us know that there's a residence address change so that we can update their voter registration record. And if they continue to vote at that location where they're registered and don't provide us an update, that's where their voting residence is.
So what you're telling me...
Follow up.
So I think what you're telling me is if you want to prevent that, you need a statutory change. Is that what you're saying? Because that's what I'm trying to figure out.
That's possible through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's possible that those things would have to be looked at and looked at what the intent of the residency of the voter is, the intent of the law to allow people to move between places and be in a temporary work site such as a work camp or something like that, because the law allows for them to do that currently.
So just follow up. I understand the law allows and we should allow people to, if they're working temporarily at one place. I'm talking about the situation where somebody sells their home and they just think it's more convenient to vote at their old address because maybe that's closer to their work, or maybe they actually like the representative there, so they figure, hey, it's a close election, I'll just, you know, continue voting there. Does the Division of Elections think that's okay?
I don't think I want to comment on whether it's okay, but,
it's,
you know,
but
I think
under
if,
current
I,
law, it's legal?
Well, I think through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think if there's a thought of having stricter laws on residency and voting, you know, I think then that's something that has to be addressed through statute.
And I'm going to suggest that maybe further investigation on this point maybe happen outside this particular hearing, given that we'll be able to hear this bill again. But I believe Representative Wool might have a question for the Division of Elections.
Yeah, just real quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that when Representative LeDoux mentioned the possible infraction that she would want to report, you said if you see someone at a polling place, you know, if you witness someone voting at a certain area. But an absentee or mail-in ballot, obviously, that wouldn't, you're not going to see someone mailing a ballot with, I think some, obviously some locations or some states are going towards more mail-in. Mm-hmm. So then the idea of detecting people voting in non where they don't reside is probably a little trickier. And I don't know if the PFD voter registration issue might clarify some residency things, but obviously that's for a later time.
Any comment, Ms. Wilson?
Through the chair, Representative Wool. Could you remind me what the first part of your statement was?
The first part was just that you mentioned if you see someone in a polling place.
Okay.
But here we're talking about absentee and mail-in stuff.
So okay, thank you.
And it looks like, you know, as a nation, we may be going more towards mail ballots.
Right.
And so then you would never see anyone in a polling place.
Okay, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wool. As I stated earlier, during the review process, the regional offices have a review process that involves their absentee review boards and their question review boards. The absentee review boards review all absentee ballots, whether it's by mail, whether it's absentee in person, whether it's special needs, and there is a review process. So if somebody within the category that's allowed to be an observer wants to observe that review process, they can challenge the eligibility of that voter at that time, and that challenge will be given to the director to review and make a determination case by case.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Ledoux.
So about, I know that by election day, there are a certain number of ballots that are already counted. Have they got, of absentee ballots, do they go through the absentee review board, or are they the absentee in-person people?
Okay.
Which is all confusing.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there are different processes of absentee. A PAV, like that's in the bill, a permanent absentee voter, is someone who currently, under the law, a permanent absentee voter is someone who we automatically send an absentee application to for them to apply to vote absentee. I believe under the new House bill, a PAV is someone that could actually be a permanent absentee voter on a list that we would automatically send them the application. Is it the application they could sign up for a number of years and be sent the ballot automatically? And then there's the absentee in-person voting where that goes through a review process. Absentee ballots all go through a review process. Early voting does not go through a review process. Early voting in its process is like voting at the polls. It's a live ballot that the voter's eligibility is, everything's right on. They're eligible to vote an early ballot, just like if they walked into the polling place, signed the precinct register, were handed their ballot, and it was counted. That's early voting is similar to that. There's no review process on the ballot. Anything that goes that's other than early voting or voting at your precinct, voting a regular ballot, everything else goes through a review. All the absentee types by mail, fax, online delivery, special needs, and all question ballots go through a review process.
Follow up.
Oh, but I'm sorry, to finish answering your question, sorry, I got on a bunny trail. No ballots are counted before the polls close on election day. So the polls close at election on election day at 8 p.m. Any absentee ballots that we received before election day, we start getting absentee ballots in you know, sometimes 3 weeks ahead of the election, and then absentee in-person starts 15 days before the election. So we start, we constantly are getting absentee ballots from that point forward through the through the deadline date to receive the absentee ballot. So our staff are receiving those ballots, we're reviewing them, we're entering them into the system to give the voter voter history, and then every one of those ballots is touched and handled by a review board separate from our staff, who does an independent review of those ballots and decides if our review was good enough or if they have questions about the decisions that we made on a full count or a partial count on those ballots that are reviewed. So then on the ballots, we'll choose a date internally for, depending on how many ballots, absentee ballots we've received up until that point, and say, okay, all the regional offices may have received absentee ballots through August 12th. And so we're going to take all those ballots received through August 12th that have been through the review process and are ready to be opened and counted. We'll include those on the election night count when the polls close. Everything else that comes in after that deadline that we, or that date that we chose, will be in subsequent night counts. But everything is reviewed and before it's opened and counted.
And follow up,
Representative Ledoux.
And so is there any provision, like when you're counting the absentees after an election, poll watchers to be there at when you're counting those early ballots too?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes, there are they're not poll watchers are at the polling place, but observers can be there when we're counting ballots and during the review process. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson, and thank you, Ms. Behnke. Representative Birch, I think this might be the last question. We'll hold this bill for
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank you for the testimony here today, and I'd like to thank the good representative from East Anchorage for her questions as well. I think this is an excellent start on a House bill. I think the highest and best thing that we can do as a legislature is assure that we move up the turnout. And I know I had extensive conversations with the namesake of this room, Representative Grunberg, on this very subject, as far as having elections, for instance, municipal elections concurrent with state elections, so you have one election day in the state. And I'm really looking forward to engaging in this as we move forward. And thank you for your time. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Birch. And when we hear this bill next time, we'll make sure to offer the division the opportunity to offer any comments on the bill at large. And that will be next Tuesday. And speaking of next week, we have four bills on Tuesday's agenda, including first hearings for HB 97 relating to the repeal of Alaska Fire Standards Council tax credits from Representative Thompson, House Bill 82 relating to off-highway driver's licenses from my office, House Bill 1, a second hearing, this piece of legislation from Representative Tuck, and finally House Bill 127, criminal convictions overturned and receiving past permanent fund dividends, as well as on Thursday we have a hearing on conflict of interest legislation from Representative Gren. And I should note that if there is an interest in amendments on this particular piece of legislation, House Bill 1, just to be able to plan out the week and sort of have enough advance time and be able to plan hearings accordingly, to please notify my office by 5 p.m. Monday, the day before it's scheduled a hearing on Tuesday. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you're interested in having public testimony before we do the amendment process or after. I just wanted to know when would be a good time to do, or when do you have planned for public testimony?
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Right now, public testimony is noticed for House Bill 1 on Tuesday.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if it seems as though there are going to be substantial amendments, we can sort of revise as needed.
Okay. Thank you.
And at this time, at 4:21 p.m., we'll be adjourned. And a reminder that we have Finance Subcommittee in 9 minutes.